Welcome to Legal Talk with attorney Kevin Flesh of Flesh Law. Auto accidents, DUIs, slip and falls, each one can change your life. But the trial-tested, trial-ready attorneys at Flesh Law relieve your legal burden. Whether you need to heal from an injury or protect your future in a criminal matter, the legal team at Flesh Law is prepared to defend your rights. Now, here's Legal Talk with your host, Scott Whatley, and attorney Kevin Flesh.
Welcome to Legal Talk. My name is Scott Whatley. We are glad you're with us. Hey, we've got our Flesh Law text line. If you ever have a legal question, send me a text, 720-201-8585, and we will get that to our exclusive attorney, Mr. Kevin Flesh. The number is 303-806-8886. I always want to get this on every show. It's always a free initial consult. And, folks, it's absolutely no charge to you. Just give Kevin a call. He'll be glad to discuss, see what you've got going on, and see if his firm can be of help. But once again, that number is 303-806-8886. Kevin Flesh, good to see you, sir.
Good to see you.
You know, boy, last week we talked on DUI things and some things that people don't know, and there is so much to know. And then you've said this: you're the most expensive Uber.
Yeah. No.
And you can see how it happens. Okay, so I'm not judging people. You can see how it happens. They're at a ball game, they're out to dinner, different things, what can happen. But man, folks, just think it through, because really, with all the ride options, and I'm just using your words, all the ride options these days, man, it may be an inconvenience to go back and get your car the next morning, but it's going to be way cheaper.
Oh, so much. So, yeah, we always talk about, I mean, when we're talking about DUIs, and actually the last discussion we have, we didn't preface this, but, yeah, it's so much easier to have a plan and just follow through with that plan, and that plan is not driving after consuming drugs or alcohol. Mm-hmm. I mean, just that's the bottom line, because the rest of it, there's just so much more anxiety and so much more expense to the alternative with me getting involved and then talking about sort of how to defend yourself through this, that doesn't ruin your life. Just smarter to just have a plan and don't get behind the wheel, period.
Right, right. Yeah. When marijuana became everywhere in Colorado, yeah. I don't remember what year it was now.
It's been a while.
Yeah. But would you say, was it safe to say there's been a rise in those type traffic stops, violations, arrests, different things?
Yeah, I would say, especially early on, because of the influx of people that moved here, because it was legal and it wasn't legal anywhere else, we had a number of DUIs relating to medical or regular marijuana, recreational marijuana, right away out of the gates relating to that, because everybody was like, well, it's legal, so I can smoke in my car and drive. I mean, there was some process to go through to make sure the education of people to realize that just like any other drug, you can't be under the influence and be behind the wheel. And so that's changed over time. What we see now is sort of the influence of multiple types of drugs or alcohol affecting people. So, you know, we get a handful of cases every year where someone is drinking and also using recreational marijuana at the same time. And so when they get a blood test done, their alcohol level may not be that high. It may actually be just barely over the legal limit, but then they'll also have marijuana in their system, so that the combo is argument, you know, the argument by the people, by the prosecution, is that the combination of the two drugs makes you impaired. And certainly since the advent of the body-worn camera footage being so prevalent in these cases, jurors have common sense. They'll be able to see what you look like on that video and determine whether or not they think you're impaired, even though maybe the blood results come back with something that is just barely over the legal limit. For both, I mean, right. Because marijuana is, there is no legal limit, but there are some experts now that will testify about sort of what the THC levels should be to not be impaired, those sorts of things. Mm-hmm. And so that those sorts of cases are a little bit more difficult, because in the past, if they had just done a blood, you know, you get a blood panel back that's just relating to alcohol. If that alcohol is fairly low, you know, and the alcohol levels now are from 0.05 to 0.08 for DWAI, and then 0.08 to anything above that, basically 0.4, because 0.4 most people aren't breathing at that point. That's kind of the range, 0.08 to 0.4, in regards to the amount of alcohol in the bloodstream. If it's fairly low, let's say under 0.1, that then would indicate that the person is impaired legally, but in the grand scheme of things, in comparison to the other cases that we see, it's not real high. Mm-hmm. And so you normally can get a better plea offer and work something out with regard to a disposition on those cases. But then you add in sort of the, and normally they're doing now with the blood panels, they'll do a drug screen as well. If you add in the marijuana, then the combo, the district attorneys have a tendency to not be as persuaded that
right.
that low BAC is not the impairing
sure.
function. So.
And we want to make sure, these shows last week, this week, it's not about how to get off of a DUI, okay? It is, we just want to inform you, you still have rights even if you've made a mistake. And that's the main part we want to get across, Kevin, and let people know you still have rights.
Exactly. And I think what's really important for folks to be educated about it is when we're talking about sort of the necessary things that you need to do to protect yourself in those situations, I'm hoping that the education really just
makes you not want to be involved.
Yeah. It really causes you to take a moment and really think about, you know, maybe I really do need a plan, because what I'm talking about today and last week is so much more significant in what the way things go down and mm-hmm. what our legal system has now sort of said to the populace. I mean, we see it through Mothers Against Drunk Driving and the advertising that they do and their victim impact panels and all of those things. The risk that you run in having alcohol or drugs in your system and causing a significant injury or death to another person is a liberty issue, because judges in Colorado don't care when there's a person that has died and you show alcohol in your system while you're driving, they're going to send you to prison.
Sure.
That's, there's very little chance that you're not going to prison. I mean, that's the bottom line. So if that's, and the difference between a first-time DUI and a first-time person that has killed someone behind the wheel with alcohol in their system, the only difference is someone's died. Right? The only difference between prison and probation is that the significance of what happened.
Right.
The person that's pulled over with mitigating circumstances, in other words, there's no significant bad driving and there's no accident, that person, and that's what judges look at, get probation. But the act itself of drinking and getting behind the wheel is exactly the same. Mm-hmm. And so that's where I think this education is helpful for people to realize it's not a risk that you want to take.
No.
It's just not. Yes, but and with, especially in the metro area, with all the advent of all the other ride shares and all the other things that you can do to get home, I'm still surprised that we continue to do the sort of work that we do, but we do, and we do a lot of them every year, and it's the same conversation that I have with folks. And some of the people that are in this situation, again, we've talked about this previously, it's an indication that their life's out of control, mm-hmm. and so we help them through that. But talking about the actual nuts and bolts of helping yourself in the moment when you've made the bad decision, but you've now been pulled over, and what things you can do to help yourself, because at the point at which you're pulled over, all of the risk is gone relating to any future problems on that particular night relating to the danger to society, because the police are getting you out of the car and you're not getting back in a car that night unless someone else is driving it.
So. Yeah, right. You're listening to Legal Talk with Attorney Kevin Flesh. All right. We talked last week again about things people probably don't know about DUI arrest, and this one we're going to talk about kind of some mistakes you may make. And Kevin, would it be fair to say that social media may still not be your friend? Because if you're taking pictures and 10 of your friends around a bar and you're all holding up a shot glass or something like that,
exactly.
and then 2 hours later you're in an accident, I mean, what could be some problems?
Exactly. So any sort of social media presence that you have on the night in which something occurs where you're arrested for either a DUI or some other event where you're the allegation is you're under the influence, especially when you have serious bodily injury, the accident that you caused, that there's serious bodily injury or death. Your social media presence is going to be the first thing that the detectives look at to see if there's anything that indicates that there was something going on that night that would help them prove that you were under the influence at the time that they mm-hmm. that you caused the incident. So much like anything else, and it's the same thing with having a phone with you, if you're going to be in a situation where there's going to be a criminal allegation brought against you, you know, the least amount of social media presence you can have is going to help you in defending yourself. Because pictures and videos and sort of those sorts of things that are on the web are very compelling to jurors when they can see something, hear something, and it's not somebody explaining what happened, but they can visualize it themselves. It makes a huge difference. I mean, we see this all the time. In the best example I can give is the NFL with individuals.
Do you remember that it was just several years back?
Yeah.
The guy and his girlfriend or wife got on an elevator.
Yep.
I mean, he punched her butt.
Mm-hmm.
And it had that just been the spoken word, like you say, oh, he struck her.
Yep.
Or whatever. And yep. he was really good.
Right.
I think Ray Rice, if my memory serves me right.
Yeah.
But,
before the video came out, everybody.
When it came out. Game over.
Yeah, and he didn't get back in the league.
Right.
And that's the same thing. That's a great example of the same thing that happens when we're defending any sort of criminal allegation, but especially these sorts of cases, because everybody doesn't need an expert to tell them what an impaired person looks like, because mm-hmm. we've all been around either ourselves or other people. We know what it looks like. We know what it smells like. We know what it feels like when you're around that sort of person. And so any sort of social media or any sort of body-worn camera footage or any sort of video that would indicate what a person looks like during that time period, specifically right after driving, that's going to be persuasive.
Right.
And that changes the complexity sometimes of how these cases resolve, in the sense of I very often have clients that will come in and tell me one story about what they think has happened with regard to the investigation of the matter. And then when we get the actual evidence, it's completely different. And it's primarily because they're under the influence.
Sure.
And they just don't have a good memory about it.
Right.
Yeah.
And again, this is a mistake. So social media, don't make a mistake there. Waiting too long to hire an attorney. We covered that last week. Quite in depth, but there's some things you got to do pretty quick there, and Kevin can help you with that. And you can go to haystackhelpradio.com, listen to previous shows as well. But Kevin, we love our police, and we're all
absolutely
back the blue. But you know what? They make mistakes too. So would a mistake be assuming the officer has everything right?
Yes. You absolutely want to scrutinize what it is exactly that they're doing, and whether or not they're doing it above board and they're following their own procedures. You don't have to worry about that when you get pulled over by the police. We'll scrutinize that later. The things that people need to do in those situations is be as courteous as possible, but still understand your constitutional rights. So you want to say as little as possible to the officer. You want to provide the documents that they ask you to provide. But beyond that, you just don't want to do much in the way of providing additional evidence that you don't have to provide. There are things that we will scrutinize later relating to reasonable suspicion. So why are you having contact with the police? Those are things that they should tell you at the scene, but they don't have to. And it's not something that you want to get into an argument with them about. Listen, you don't have you don't have reasonable suspicion to be talking to me. Get your sergeant. I see these sort of examples out there where people tell the officer what the law is. Some of those situations are good, but most of them are much more combative than they need to be. Mm-hmm. That's what we have trial courts for. That's what you have lawyers for, to argue in more sanitized situation and not on the side of the road.
Yeah.
Arguments with police officers on the side of the road really generally don't lead to productive discussions because the officer's in control.
Mm-hmm. And you don't want to say, hey, this is going to be a big hassle. I want to try to get this over. I'm just going to plead guilty, because there's consequences to a first, isn't
absolutely
there?
There's definitely consequences to the first. You're going to have, if for example you're like, yep, I'm taking responsibility, I'm going to plead straight up to this DUI, when there are things that we can do for mitigation or things that we can do to suggest that the process wasn't done appropriately, We've had a number of cases over the years where people are willing to take responsibility, but at the same time, we want to make sure that the process is done correctly. And if it's not, and those cases are dismissed, if you've pled straight up on your own, you know, you've really not taken advantage of our Constitution and the system that's set up to protect people from the standpoint of being told and the realization that we're not guilty until the prosecution proves it. Right. And there's a real process for that. And we've got to make sure that that process is used so that your rights and the rights of future individuals are protected. Because even though you've maybe committed the crime and you're willing to admit to it, there's still things that we can do to minimize those sorts of things in your life. Because what you don't want to have happen is you plead and you don't really fight the first one and you get a couple more down the road because you've got a problem with alcohol and your decision making, and then you've sort of set you up for failure.
Yeah.
You know, because you haven't learned anything as you've gone along. And I want to help people in teaching them what's going on in their life and helping them realize what's going on to make them better people, number one, and number two, so that you don't have this happen again.
Right. Again, we've got our Flesh Law text line. If you're listening somewhere and maybe can't call in at all, but you'd have a question for Kevin, that Flesh Law text line is 720-201-8585. This is something I've never thought about. CDL drivers are people that maybe have a regular driver's license and a CDL. Are these cases handled different? Are there different consequences? Whether you're driving a semi or whether you're driving your car,
yep.
I mean, even if you're driving your car and you have a CDL license, that could probably be a problem for work.
It does. Automatically, you lose your CDL for a year. No ability to drive.
Yep. Okay.
So you're driving your personal car, but you're a CDL driver, and you get pulled over for a DUI. If you go through the DMV process and they restrict your license relating to your regular privilege, they'll also restrict your CDL for a year minimum, and there's no ability to have an interlock in a CDL. You just don't have the ability to drive under a CDL. And it's absolutely something that if you're a CDL driver, you definitely want to get in contact with us right away. And it also affects CDLs is interesting because there's this federal no masking law, which basically says that if you get charged with any sort of traffic offense, not just DUIs, but it's, you know, other offenses in the state relating to your CDL license. Mm-hmm. Jurisdictions are not supposed to make a plea deal to you to reduce points and do those sorts of things.
Right.
And so those are also situations where we help lots of CDL drivers making a determination as to what we can do.
Right.
About how we can help them with their driver's license.
Yeah. And, you know, there are so many things to go over. Okay, like what happens then after your arrest and to go through things. I tell you, we'll cover that on another show. But, Kevin, I want to get to this because I think the best defense always starts with who you hire to defend you, right?
Completely agree.
So I think this is where we need to spend some time right here. So I guess the way to ask is, what separates a good DUI attorney?
Yep.
You know.
Absolutely. So when people call and they're calling around to make determination as to who's going to be their best fit, I think what's really important is to talk with individuals who purportedly do this sort of work and ask, you know, how many DUI trials have you done? Through trial. How many, you know,
because there's good to add those two words.
Correct.
Through trial. Okay.
Yeah. And why did you take those cases to trial? What is it that made you believe that trial was the best option? For those of us that do this sort of work, and that's a question that I would love to have somebody ask me. What they normally ask is, well, what's your success rate? Well, my success rate is good because we're really selective about the cases that we go to trial on, because otherwise, you know, the issue is risk versus reward. It's a lot of money for our clients to go to trial, and there's got to be, and risk, right? Because depending upon what the circumstance is, if you've got an alcohol-related offense, a DUI, and they're offering you a DWAI, and your likelihood to prevail at trial is fairly low, why spend the money with you when the result we already know is probably better with a plea bargain than if you go to trial. Mm-hmm. It's those sorts of things. So the other thing that people will want to know is, well, what do you do to protect people in the trial process? What is it that makes you different than other people? And then we start talking about the process of really scrutinizing the evidence, talking about what the people have to prove, and motions practice, and trying to get the case resolved prior to trial. with really advocacy with the prosecutors and being there enough that they know you and they know your reputation, that if you're setting it for trial, you want the prosecutor to say, okay, why are you setting this for trial? What is it that I often ask prosecutors when they make an initial offer that, let's say, is plead to the charge, okay, what can I do to compel you to change that offer? Because that's really not an offer. And I'll say straight up to a prosecutor, and many times it's lawyers that are younger that have less experience, that they're just trying to get through their day, and they're making an offer that makes no sense because it's pleading guilty to the crime. But then trying to stop them, and I can do this sometimes with what is it that will make you change your mind about this case? What is it that you're interested in hearing about this case that will give you pause to give us a different offer
right. Before
we set it for trial? So then we have that conversation. And sometimes it's several court appearances to get them recognizing what it is that's important for them to get the case resolved, and also to potentially go to their supervisor to make the case that there should be a different offer made just under the circumstances.
Right.
So talking, so in your initial consultation about that, and then find out if the lawyer wants to handle the case on a flat fee versus maybe an hourly fee. We do almost all of our work on a flat fee because it's advantageous for the client to know exactly what they're going to have to pay, the fact that we're going to have several court appearances and we're not afraid of going to the court. Mm-hmm. If you have somebody that is wanting to only have the case done on an hourly basis, then you've got to think about, well, are they not doing enough of these cases to know how much work they are so that they won't quote me a flat fee, or are they going to try to really turn that hourly fee into a much larger fee than it would be on a flat fee basis?
Sure, sure.
So you could ask them, well, what's your average hourly cost for this sort of case, so that you're comparing apples to apples?
Right.
Because let's say a person that says, well, I'll charge you hourly for my time, but I want a $2,500 retainer up front. You don't know what the end game is going to be there, if it's a $5,000 or if it's a $10,000 cost to you as a consumer versus a flat fee. You know how much it's going to be right off the bat. Mm-hmm. And then what do you charge for trial? Because trial is generally not included in a flat fee because we generally don't go to trial. So what's your trial fee? And you'll have a good sense then from the person of what their trial fee is as to how interested they're going to trial. If they quote you, let's say, $4,000 to handle the case up to the day of trial, but then they want $20,000 for trial, what time periods are you talking about? Or is it that you just don't want to go to trial, so you're charging me a whole lot of money not to go to trial, because most people don't have that sort of money on a first-time DUI to go to trial.
Wow.
So it's those sorts of things. And then just really talking to them, I think, for people talking about just DUIs in general, about what the lawyer sees as issues in any sort of case. And the lawyer should be spending time with you to get sort of an understanding of the facts so that they can give you some advice based upon what you tell them the facts are. And I always preface my conversation, well, if what you're telling me is true.
I can't tell you how many times I've said that through the years, you know, because of you.
Yeah.
I mean, people call me and tell me about a company or something,
right,
you know, screwing them over.
Yeah,
and I'm
yeah.
like, all right, if what you're telling me is true,
yep.
okay, then here's my thoughts,
yes.
you know.
Yeah, but if we get, because there's always more evidence that we get.
Yeah, I know.
So those are the sorts of things that we really want to take a look at.
Right. And when you do this as much you do, I mean, you have a great understanding of the Colorado DUI law. Somebody uses a family attorney or, you know, a bankruptcy attorney that's a friend of mine that has the legal right to, I started to say legal ability, but legal right to help you may not be the best choice.
Yes.
If they don't understand.
That's exactly right.
To deal with.
Yep.
True. Yeah, for sure. What about out-of-state folks? How does it work different? Because people come here for all kinds of events, concerts, mm-hmm. Rockies games.
Yep.
Not going to understand why you might get drunk after a Rockies game. But anyway, no.
Or during it.
Yeah, or during it. But how do, is that a more complicated
It can
case?
Be. Yep.
Okay.
For two purposes. One, the DMV side of it is generally more complicated because we're dealing with driver's licenses not in Colorado. So you may lose your privilege to drive in Colorado, but it's not limited in other states. Depending upon the circumstance.
So you go by Colorado law if they live in Kansas or Nebraska or Arizona or whatever.
Right. But there may not be the communication between the states relating to their driver's license there. So, and whether or not their license was actually taken here, whether or not the test was done within 2 hours. I mean, there's a bunch of things that we have to consider. And then the other thing is they're in another state. Now we're able to do a lot of the appearances virtually, so we just have to request virtual appearances by the court.
Okay.
And in fact, I just finished a case with a fellow that was in Illinois. He was up in Greeley, got charged up there, and it ended up we were able to handle all of the case remotely, so he never had to come back to Colorado.
Oh, wow.
So that's also an advantage. We also can help people just get through the process a little bit more smoothly, so to help them understand what the laws are. For example, if I have a client that it looks like it's a case that we can't really fight on the facts, but we can fight on the mitigation piece, so that we get them involved in doing level 2 alcohol education therapy, the MAD panel, maybe doing some other things to show their contrition and also their recognition that they've got a problem, that they need to work on their alcohol, for mm-hmm. example. So we'll have them get involved with AA or some other types of addiction counseling, and then work on the alcohol education and therapy, and we'll get them doing those things right away, so that 4 or 5 months down the road, when we're trying to resolve the case, we've got all of this really good evidence to show the things that they took seriously and that they're doing things that the court won't make them do,
right.
That they were doing it voluntarily already, recognizing what they did to the community. Those sorts of arguments help us tremendously mm-hmm. when we're arguing about sentencing in the end.
Right. Got about 60 seconds for this, so it's unfair. We'll cover it next week, but somebody they're in jail, they're arrested. How do they get out?
Yeah. So they'll get in front of a judge. The judge will set a bond, and then you can bond out. A lot of times it's a signature bond. It's called a personal recognizance bond, or it's a small cash or surety bond. So if it's a surety where you're going to have to go out and get a bondsman, you'll make a phone call to a family member, tell them the amount, and then they'll go find a bondsman to place the bond. And then once the bond is placed, you're supposed to be let out within 6 hours of that bond being placed.
Okay.
If it's a signature bond, same thing. You sign that you're going to appear for the next court appearance, and then they'll release you from custody.
And your first call when you get out, 303.
Call us.
806-8886.
Exactly.
Well, folks, I can tell you, and I encourage you, if you missed last week, go to our website, haystackupradio.com. Listen to last week. You will see there's a lot involved. So main thing, as Kevin said, keep your conversations to a minimum with an officer.
Exactly.
Right? Tell you who you are. Show the documents. Other than that, zip it.
Yep, exactly. And wait and see how they're going to respond.
And, man, that's hard, isn't it,
yep.
for people?
It is. They like to talk their way through it. They think they can talk their way out of it. And generally, you can't. The officers have made up their mind based upon what their training and experience is, and you're not going to be able to talk your way out of it.
Yeah. And, hey, again, a lot of ways to get home safely. And, hey, I know sometimes we just make bad decisions, and that's what Kevin's here for, to help you protect your rights. But help everybody out, okay?
Yep.
Don't overdrink and drive. And that'll be a great blessing to many of us. So, Kevin, thank you for your time, sir, and we'll look forward to our show next week.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us today for Legal Talk. Once again, always a free consultation, folks. It'll cost you nothing but your time to give Kevin's office a call, 303-806-8886, our Flesh Law text line, 720-201-8585. Thanks for being with us today for Legal Talk.
Call now for a free consultation with Flesh Law, 303-806-8886, 303-806-8886, or visit fleshlawfirm.com. That's FLESCH, fleshlawfirm.com. A proven team dedicated to your legal needs.
The views and opinions expressed on KLZ 560 are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect those of Crawford Broadcasting, the station, management, employees, associates, or advertisers. KLZ 560 is a Crawford Broadcasting God and Country station.
Zip around the neighborhood, commute to work, or ride the trails on an e-bike. Hi, I'm Randy Carancy, founder of eBike of Colorado. E-bikes are electric bikes that are fun and easy to ride. Pedal assist technology flattens the steepest hills. At eBike of Colorado, we have 14 major brands to choose from, and our expert staff will find you the perfect bike. Just try it. Take a free test ride at eBike of Colorado in downtown Louisville next to the historic grain elevator. Open 7 days a week from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. Learn more at eBikeofColorado.com. Just try it.
560 KLZ, your home station. Haystack Help Radio brings you Your Legacy, Your Way, the show that puts you in control of your future. Hosted by Scott Whatley and featuring estate planning attorney Carolyn Duncan, this program is your go-to source for everything you need to know about protecting your assets, your family, and your legacy. Whether it's a will, a trust, or a full estate plan, if you don't decide, the state will decide for you. Attorney Carolyn Duncan brings the experience you need to help you gain peace of mind and avoid costly legal pitfalls. So ask yourself, what kind of legacy do I want to leave behind? Don't wait for a crisis before you plan. Now here's Your Legacy, Your Way with your hosts, Scott Whatley and Attorney Carolyn Duncan.
Welcome to Your Legacy, Your Way. My name is Scott Whatley. We are glad you are with us. We hope you caught the show last week. If you did not, you can go to haystackhelpradio.com. Click on the podcast. Listen there. We went through a lot of great questions with our exclusive estate planning attorney, Carolyn Duncan, here. And we're going to pick those back up today with more questions. So, Carolyn, how are you?
I am all right. How about yourself?
I'm doing good. Boy, these have been some great questions. And I can't think of anything in any topics that I do throughout the week with all my clients that people probably don't want to discuss more than this. You know? I mean, it is something that people tend to put off. It?
You know, they do. I get a lot of people that come in that they have estate planning documents, but then their kids were really young, and then you're like, well, how old are they now? And they could be in their 30s, and they've had this for like 20 years, and they're like, we now have grandchildren. Mm-hmm. And so they put off revising it until now, and usually it's the grandchildren, or they're doing whatever, they're just thinking differently, or they come across it and they go, golly, that doesn't even apply anymore. But any kind of estate document you do, whether it is a will or a trust, it's not static. It's living and growing.
Right.
You know, as things change, you can change that, and you keep it current and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, sometimes it's just good to look at what you have and go, oh gosh, am I still happy with that?
Yeah.
Or am I not?
Right. Yeah. Things change, as we
things
said.
Change.
I think we ended that with the last show.
Yeah, people tell me all the time, you know, can I change this? And, you know, how much does that cost? And it's like, oh, it depends on if you're on my maintenance plan or not. But I said, you know, I don't carve these in stone. So, yes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, right. I don't use a chisel, so we can change them.
Exactly. Well, bring up your maintenance plan. Let's explain what that is.
Yeah, so we started this late last year, earlier this year, and it's a small fee. In my mind, it's a small fee, but what it allows you to do, it's an annual subscription. So if you want to make changes to your documents, we're going to make the changes to your documents. You know, we may do a trust amendment, but if you really want to restate the trust, we'll do it, and we'll do it all for that $650 fee, because it's an insurance policy in my mind, and sometimes I'm going to win and sometimes you're going to win, because mm-hmm. the goal here is that you continue on it each year, but that you don't have all these big changes. But I can tell you, this year so far, I've done 3 or 4 restatement of trusts, and sometimes it's real easy of, hey, here's some updated powers of attorney, but it's a set fee. You know what it's going to be.
Right.
Kind of deal. And it also has a couple of perks with it. We do the a legal directives card. It's the size of a credit card or your driver's license, but it's for your medical documents only. There are no financial documents on it. So if you're in a car accident and you have it behind that driver's license or whatever, there is a website you go to, you put in this, you put in the PIN, it's all on the card, and all of a sudden your medical documents come up. So it's your medical power of attorney, it's your HIPAA authorization, it's your living will, it's your emergency contacts. Are you allergic to anything? You know, it's to me, mm-hmm. I don't carry those documents in my back pocket. How are you going to know? Kind of deal. So in my world, I see it. I've gone, oh man, that's the best thing since sliced bread, and I wish I came up with that.
Mm-hmm.
And then we do newsletters and all that, kind of keep them up to date. I'd like to expand it as the program grows, but we just launched it and we're actually doing pretty well with it. A little surprised, going, wow, you know, people are interested in this.
Right.
And we've been thinking about doing that for a couple of years, and we just never got the quite right launch until this last year of going, okay, now we're clicking.
Right, right.
Now we've got something.
Yeah.
You know, so.
And like you say, sometimes it might be quick and easy. Other times it may be several hours and the customer makes out.
You know, yeah, it really is. It, to me, it's no different than, you know, having that car accident. Yeah, you need your car insurance, but you may never have the accident. Mm-hmm. So if you never have the accident, well, the insurance company's winning.
Right.
But when you need them.
Yeah. They pay your claim and drop you.
Well, I'm not saying that.
No, that happens a lot. Man.
You know, but that's what it's about.
Right.
You know, and I think at the moment we have it priced appropriately. I may not feel that way next year or 2 years from now, but I think right now we're at a good starting point.
Well, you know, when you drafted everything, it's just a natural. Mm-hmm. You don't have to go to somebody else and start over, you know.
No.
And
no.
All that. So it is. No matter what, it's going to be it's going to be easier and simpler just because you drafted them.
Correct.
Right.
So, like, if I'm doing a new power of attorney, I'm just going to take the old one, change what you want to change, and change the dates.
Right.
You know, so you're right. In that regard, it is. You know, doing trust amendments or will amendments, that's a little bit trickier depending on what they're doing. But, you know, it still works.
Right. All right. As I said, last week we went through several questions, and we're going to get through as many as we can here. And these are just common questions, so they're kind of all over the board, so to speak, with estate planning, but very, very common questions. And today we're going to start with, what's the difference between a will and a trust?
Okay. A will is basically your document where you name who is your personal representative. Their job is to gather the assets, pay off the debt, and distribute what's left over to the people that you want to get your stuff, and you dictate how they get it. You know, depending on their age, you can say, well, they're not going to get it until they're age 30, or you can do some asset protection for them within the will. But the biggest point about a will is it typically goes through probate. You can avoid probate. If you are a husband and wife and you own a house and it's joint right of survivorship, okay, that's going to be an easy one, and you don't have to go to probate for that. It's the level below you that's going to end up in probate. Mm. So if you die in the same car accident, uh-oh, joint right of survivorship doesn't do a whole lot because the two people are dead and are now going to probate. And real property always goes through probate unless it's a beneficiary deed or it is joint right of survivorship. Okay. The other thing that kicks in a probate, right now it's $88,000. So if your combined assets are over $88,000 and you do not have designated beneficiaries, that's going to probate as well. And so the example that I use, and I'm not really a car person in sense of, I'm happy with transportation. I'm not saying I want, you know, this beat up old whatever, but
sure.
I'm not really into this. And for me, I'm like, oh, I don't know that I'd spend that much. But then when my husband was alive, we did have a Porsche. So I have spent that much, but not now.
Right.
And so a couple of years ago when I was talking to one person, I'm going, well, what do you have? And he's telling me, well, I have a truck. And I'm going, well, what's the value of the truck? And he tells me $125,000. And I'm like, oh, my gosh. I'm like, I'm probably never going to spend that on that. And I said, you need to put that truck and all your fun little toys in the name of your trust because no one wants to go to probate over a truck. And you have to think about it that way of these vehicles are getting more expensive than right now our limit. And I think we're kind of on the low side. So, for example, California, their smallest state affidavit, I think, is like $150,000. Well, ours just got up to 88. You know, for a long time, it was like 66,000. And it doesn't take a whole lot to do that.
Sure.
And some people think, well, yeah, I've got everything under control. And then all of a sudden, they find a bank account that doesn't have anybody listed, and it's got, you know, $90,000 in it. Well, guess what? You're going to probate to grab it. That's the big thing. So wills, you can avoid probate, and it's usually the husband and wife thing, or it's designated beneficiaries will help you, and you can avoid it that way. Where a trust is the same thing, you've got a trustee whose whole job is to gather the assets, pay off the debt, distribute what's left over, and the trust is dictating who's getting it, how they're getting it, and when they're getting it kind of deal. A will, if you go to probate, that's done in the light. And a trust, that's done in the dark. You're not going anywhere. No one's really knowing what's going on. If you have to file a trust registration upon the death of somebody, one of the grantors, and that's not required in Colorado, you can do it. I do it very rarely. I usually do it when I think, ooh, there's a potential problem. I am establishing my jurisdiction, and I am chopping off time that you have to object. You know, if I don't do that, you're going to have 12 months from the date of death. If I do that and I send you a copy of the trust, then I think it's 120 days. So I'm chopping off time. And I don't do that often. But that's why you would do a trust registration. But what's interesting is the trust registration, it's still in the dark. You're saying, hey, I'm the trustee. I've got the documents. But you're not listing any of the beneficiaries. You're not giving out the addresses. You're not doing anything. So you're keeping it as much in the dark as you can. And that's where the big difference. They have the same job, just under a different format of getting it done.
Right. You're listening to Your Legacy Your Way with attorney Carolyn Duncan. And she is kind enough to offer our listeners here to the show free half-hour consult, so take advantage of that. Her number, 303-394-2358, and her website is duncanlegal.com. All right, we just mentioned probate there 50 times in what you just stated. So,
but I could still answer this question.
Yeah, so probate, court-supervised process, right?
Yes and no.
Okay. All right.
You know, you're one of the things that you said the question was about of probate and why do people want to avoid it? A lot of people want to avoid it because I think of the word probate and that what they associate it with. I've gone, oh my gosh, it's going to take forever. It's going to go on and it's going to cost a lot of money. It could be. You know, but in Colorado, we've got two ways of doing it. We have the informal probate, which you're in the court system, so you have to follow their rules, but you're not going to court every other day and all of that. And so it's like you file an application, you say, hey, I want to be the personal representative. The court reviews it and says, yep, you're the personal representative. You get the letters. Great, you got the letters, that's the authority to act. You file your information of appointment, which is to the beneficiaries of saying, hey, I'm now the personal representative. You have to do an inventory, you have to do an accounting, you have to file the final tax return. By law, a probate is open at least 6 months. It doesn't mean it closes at 6 months and 3 days. It's really, in my mind, the timing of the last income tax return. When my father died, he died in December. I filed it in his tax return in April. I didn't need to do another one because everything was contained within the year he died. But depending on when you die and what's going on, we did one that he died in October, but the bonds weren't cashed in until January, so they now have to do a 2026 tax return in 2027. So it's all timing there.
Right.
And very rarely do I have one that closes around that six-month mark because you're usually waiting on something. But people just don't like the word probate and they don't want to do it. But that's informal. If you're doing formal probate, you have a judge involved. You know, you have an accounting. Well, you not only have to file the accounting with the judge, but you have to provide all the documentation with it. Informal, I still have to do the accounting. I still get all the documentation, but I don't have anyone looking at it and approving it. The interesting thing about formal probate is you can do pieces of formal probate. You can do an informal probate to get the personal representative appointed. And then at the end, if you really want to close it, you can say, I'm going to do a formal closing of the accounting and let the judge do it. And I haven't done that, but I think my reasoning, if I had to do it, is if I have people that are questioning what's going on.
Right.
And so I now want someone bigger to say, okay, I agree with the accounting, and they sign off on it.
Right. When we people talk about last will and testament, financial power of attorney, medical power of attorney, living will, advanced directive, HIPAA, is that about everything that's usually included in just an estate plan, those things right there?
Yeah. If you do a will-based plan, those would be the documents that you would want. Mm-hmm. If you do a trust-based plan, you would not only have a trust and like the certificate of trust, which is the we came, we saw, we did, the assignment of personal property, you would have more items. But even with that, you would still have a will. It would be a pour over will. So it's a very specific will. It is a safety net, and it says, hey, we would use it to go capture an asset that maybe should have been put in the trust and it wasn't for whatever reason. We would go out, we'd open the probate, we'd go capture the asset, and the only place it can go is it pours over into the trust. The trust is the controlling document. And the timing of when you probate a pour-over will depends on what you're doing. So if you have a house that wasn't put into the trust, depending on what you're doing, if you don't open the probate until 12 months after the date of death, then you avoid a lot of the things you have to do in that first year.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So it, in my mind, it kind of simplifies it and all of that. But if I need the money and we need to do, like, go get the bank accounts or whatever, well, then you have to file the legal ad. It publishes once a week in a newspaper, and you're like, going, oh, I've never filed a legal ad in the Denver Post. It's usually the smaller little newspapers. Like, if you're in the Subway sandwich shop and you see a pile of papers on top of the trash can, that's probably where you're going to find legal ads.
Right,
in the barber shop,
right,
kind of thing. You really got to be wanting to find it to do it. But trust me, if your job is to find the legal ads, you know all these smaller little newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that it's not going to be found, but that you have to get that done, and you have to do your inventory and your accounting and all that. You're doing in probate, you've got to do those jobs. So if you have a trust, you still have to do an accounting. You still have to do an inventory. You don't have to do the legal ad. You don't have to do a trust registration. It's more in your line, but the big difference is creditors with a trust, they have 12 months from the date of death to file a claim. Doesn't mean you can't do something before that 12 months.
Mm-hmm.
It just kind of depends on what's going on.
Right.
You know, if there's a lot of money there and you're like, oh, I want to make a distribution, but I'm going to hold back X because this is what the accountant thinks the taxes are going to be next year, fine. We can do that. That's an interim accounting.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like you can't do anything for 12 months. It's just like whether it's a will or a trust and you're dealing with a house, I get asked a lot, well, when can I put the house on the market for sale? If we're getting letters, whether letters testamentary, which means there's a will, or letters of administration, no will, I'm like, well, you know, once you get the certified copy of the letters, you know, you can put the house on the market 10 minutes from now for all I care.
Right.
That's the authority to act.
Right.
It's not waiting a certain amount of time.
Gotcha. Should every adult over 18 have what we just mentioned?
I don't know that every adult over 18 should have this. I think if you have a college student and they're going away, or even someone who's, they don't even have to be in college, but they've moved away for a job or whatever, car accidents happen all the time. And if they don't have like a medical power of attorney or a general power of attorney, well, I'll deal with the medical. If they don't have a medical power of attorney and they're in that car accident, unless the person's really able to talk and walk and say, this is it, and I give the authority, or if you have something maybe in your wallet, but if you're calling around going, gosh, I don't know where my kid is, and I'm calling hospitals, They're not going to tell you. My mom and dad knew some people that were on a cruise with them, and it turns out that their son was in a car accident when they get off this cruise. And we're talking like a 30-day cruise, and their son's not there to say, hey, how are you? They would not give them. They were calling hospitals and, no, we can't give you that information. It turned out he was in the hospital, but what do you do?
Man, that'd be frustrating too.
So, you know, it's not only good for the college students or the younger ones, but, and I think even financial or general power of attorney, that at least allows you to get into bank accounts, get into an apartment, if they're living in an apartment, kind of stuff. Do they necessarily need a living will, life or death situation? I don't know. At 18, I'm not sure that's what I'd want to be thinking about and talking about.
Right.
You know, if you're 18 and you have a minor child, then yeah, I think you need a will because you need to say who is your guardian and your conservator for your minor child. And the earliest you can do these documents is at age 18. Okay. So, you know.
So especially think about all you folks out there that may have a child going off to college or you got friends that do, get them to think about this.
Oh, right? Indeed.
Call you. And the number again is 303-394-2358. All right. Next question here, and you're doing very well on these. two weeks of questions. All right. What are events, and I guess I could call them life-changing events or whatever, that you would say you need to update your plan when one of these happen?
Well, you know, kind of looking at this, some of this the law is going to take care of for you. Not that I'm saying you don't need to review your plan. So let's say I'm getting a divorce and I'm now divorced and I, you know, my have an estate plan and my spouse is listed for everything. Well, Colorado has a law that says, hey, if you're divorced, then naturally we think you wouldn't want this person to do this. So even though they are listed as this, we're going to treat them as if they predeceased you, and we're going to go to your next one down. We're not going to put your ex-spouse into that position. The only exception would be is if you updated your estate planning documents and you said, I am divorced from, you know, my spouse, but I want my spouse to do X. Right. You have to specifically spell it out. Otherwise, we're going to act as if they predeceased you because they're like, oh, yeah, I get you got divorced, but you might, that may not be your first thing to go, hey, let me go look at this. I think birth of children, when I do them, and I know that they're going to, their hope and wishes are they're going to have more than one child, but
sure. Now
we're only dealing with the first child. You know, I'll put in, you know, the name of the first child and say, in any child born hereafter. I don't have to do that to include it, because if you did it and you had one child and the other one was born later, they're still going to get their share. It's not right. Like they're going to be not considered and not in line. People like to see their name in print, especially when they're older, you know, going, oh, you did this, but you named brother to this, but how come I'm not included, kind of deal. So people like to see their name in print. I literally could say my residuary, which is the rest and remaining stuff after I do my specific gifts, I give to my descendants, and I don't have to even put a name down. Descendants are your bloodline. It's your children. It's your grandchildren. I don't do that because people like to see their name in print.
Right.
And it's not like newspaper print, but when something happens and they're dealing with these documents, it's like, oh, how did I not make it in? Or actually, I had one not too long ago. It says, we think we're in this, but it's going to the descendants. And I'm talking to the brothers, and their dad died. Oh, gosh, it must have been 80s, 85, 90-ish. And I'm going, no. That's you. Your descendants. You know, you're right. You're in here. But they were questioning, we don't see our names in here, but we're pretty sure after mom, we get it.
Right.
You know, and I believe that for a long time. People like to see their name in print.
Sure. Absolutely.
I think with grandchildren and all that, you want to do that. I think another time you need to think about this is if you say, I want my I'll use my own example. For a long time before I was married, on my estate planning documents, my first choice was my father. You know, hey, my father will be the person that does this. And then I think I went to a brother. And before I was married, but it had already been a while, I was going, oh, he's getting a little older. Not that he couldn't have handled it at that age, mm-hmm. but I'm like, going, oh, you know. And so I then took my father off and I put my brother instead.
Gotcha.
You know, so you have to think about that as well. And then when I married Bill, you know, that changed.
Sure.
All the way around.
Right.
But I'm just saying you have to kind of think about, wow, you know, are they moving down? Getting slow here? Are they capable of doing this? Do, you know, mm-hmm. all of that good stuff.
Right.
Moving states, no. State plan will move with you.
Okay.
Okay. If I were to, in Georgia, the way they did it specifically is you could have your will from the state of Colorado, but you move to Georgia and you die in Georgia and you never update it, so you take Colorado. In Georgia, it would just be you are probating a foreign will. And when we say foreign will in that regard, we're not talking about something that was made in Great Britain or Germany or whatever. It's foreign as in it's not a Georgia will, it's Colorado will. But we're going to accept it and we're going to do it. The big potential problem is if you don't update it and there's going to be a fight over stuff, in theory, Georgia would have to do the trial based on Colorado law. In reality, does that happen? I don't know. I've never litigated that.
Right, right.
You know.
Interesting.
And if you own property in another state, so you're a resident of Colorado, you got your Colorado will, and you own property in Arizona, and you die, then you have to follow what the Arizona rules are so you can go deal with that property if you have to get it through probate. Colorado has a very easy way of doing it. Colorado says, okay, if you are Arizona resident and you have, you know, a mountain house here in Colorado, you just get us this triple exemplified copy of true and correct. It just means it's signed three times with three certifications, every document that was ever filed. You file it here and we're going to say, you're good to go. You don't even have to do a new letters. You're just going to use Arizona's letters of thing. We're really simple. Other states like Georgia, and since I would practice in Georgia for 10 years, I kind of know how that one works. You have to file an application of going, hey, yeah, I got this foreign will, and you're doing like a second probate in that state just to get that property. Colorado is definitely easier, but each state does it differently.
Right. A lot to know. The good part is you and I don't have to know it because Carolyn Duncan knows it, our exclusive estate planning attorney. Her number, 303-394-2358. As I mentioned earlier, Carolyn's kind enough to offer our listeners a free half-hour consult. And we wrapped up last week's show with this. I want to mention this, too. You may think you have a plan. Hey, bring it in. Let her check it out. And she'll work out a deal with you to do that. But, you know, have everything up to date. You've probably seen a few. I've got about 35 seconds here. But you've probably seen a few where it was more confusing with the plan they had because it was so outdated.
Yes. Or if they are just making so many changes, right. You're like going, oh, you know, this trust amendment or this codicil is going to be like 12, 15 pages. Let's just do something new.
Sure.
You know, let's, or if they've done a couple of amendments.
Right.
Let's smush just it together.
Easier. Yeah. That's a good way to end it. Smush it together. All right. Carolyn, thanks so much. Thanks for being with us today for Your Legacy, Your Way. And once again, Carolyn's number. Folks, take advantage of this. Now's as good a time as any to get your estate plan done. 303-394-2358. Thanks for being with us today. Leave it right here on KLZ 560.
Views and opinions expressed on KLZ 560 are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect those of Crawford Broadcasting, the station, management, employees, associates, or advertisers. KLZ 560 is a Crawford Broadcasting God and Country station.